Videotape number 19.
Hello, my name is Sang Freud and I'll be moderating this panel. I want to start off and let everybody know first that the original moderator, Richard Thieme, had a family emergency, wasn't able to attend. So those who came to see him can go ahead and leave now. He did send me some of his notes, and I'll be going over a lot of that. Richard, if you don't know him, Richard runs ThemeWorks.com. He's a speaker, wonderful guy. If you haven't read any of his newsletters he sends out, he's a writer. He's been called everything from a digital priest or whatever. You know. He's a philosopher type, Sterling-esque reporter, writer, and an excellent speaker, and a heck of a nice guy. That's right. We start with the tree frog to my left. I'm going to start all the way at the far end. Let's see who it is down there. We got Jeremy Roche. He is the vulnerability manager at securityfocus.com. He's also the co-author of Tracer X, which is a new fantastic tool coming out. Next to him, Dean Turner. He's an InfoWar analyst for Security Focus. Dean's currently working on his PhD in information warfare at the University of Calgary and the University of Birmingham in England. Can't see who's next. Space Rogue, who's an employee of Loft Heavy Industries Incorporated. He's the maintainer of the WACMAC Archives, editor-in-chief of Hacker News Network. Sardistic. As a member of the Cult of the Dead Cow, author of Back Orifice. He's currently developing some autonomous intelligence software and some other really cool stuff. I think he's going to talk about this coming weekend if you want to hang around for that. Mike Schiffman to my immediate left. I know, he said to skip you. No, I'm kidding. Okay, we got Dr. Mudge, senior scientist of Loft Heavy Industries, and long hair. Mike Schiffman to my left, senior security consultant for ISS. He's the author of Firewalk, co-author of Firewalk.
Yeah,
co-author of Firewalk and LibNet. And he's also the co-author of Tracer X with Mr. Roshan at the very end there. And that'll be coming up soon to a theater near you. And myself, I'm just the moderator that took over for Richard. I really don't have anything important. That's right. Absolutely. Richard sent some stuff over. Competitive intelligence is what we put this panel together to discuss. You may notice a lack of military or government personnel. It was not an intentional snub on either one of those, but we wanted to look at it from a corporate angle. Some of the people on this panel have consulted and contracted to military and government institutions. Shut up. All right. So what we want to get is kind of an insider's view of someone that was not constrained. Constrained as a lot of the military and government people are. By what they can and can't say. At the outset, we also wanted to mention that this is a not who do you work for, what have you done kind of panel. Most of them will refuse those kind of questions only because some of them are constrained by the corporations that they've done consulting work for. It's also irrelevant to what we're up here to discuss today. We want to keep kind of on focus. Competitive intelligence is a pretty broad topic category. It's really a new field in that the marriage of technology with corporations have brought intelligence to a huge new light, only because mom and pop can now sit at home and surf the web and figure out how many florists are in their community, and if they want to start one, they can find that out immediately almost, right? So we've got this gross overabundance of intelligence. We want to discuss some things here on how that's works, paging me. How that proliferates across the internet, and how it's done, how it's changed intelligence gathering, how government and military are having to change the way that they gather intelligence. And Richard's got some thoughts on that I just want to read through real quick. The publicity these days all goes to the so-called hackers who leave graffiti at websites. That keeps the minds of the public off the real threat of hardcore hacking, the discovery and retrieval of competitive intelligence and its use to leverage power and advantage. The gray world is bigger than ever. As boundaries between countries are redrawn and multinationals wield more political and economic power than many countries, the necessity of rethinking our nested loyalties to country, to company, to our small trusted network of colleagues or friends, to the intelligence community itself, and to ourselves and our own survival is essential. Forget about distinctions. This is what it comes down to. Modular units. Modular groups of people committed to one another for now. Working together using the most sophisticated tools to know what someone else is doing, has done, or intends to do. That's the easy part. The harder part is interpreting the data in terms of a human field of subjectivity that defines and gives meaning and purpose to all symbolic information. Data without interpretation is not even data. It's chicken shit left on the barn room floor. Which is true. Quotes. I want to, yeah, sick. S-I-C. That's his stuff there. Which I kind of like to talk to Dean a little bit about. We were discussing this, and because of the large amounts of information that's out there, hackers, security personnel, information technology managers don't even know what to protect these days. Our PR people, our marketing people, they give out information in corporations that could be possibly assembled by someone who knows how to reflect what a corporation is actually doing.
I just want to say one thing real quick. I think that we maybe as a panel should all try and define exactly what competitive intelligence means to us, and you know, get a sort of working definition, because it is sort of a vague term, and not a lot of people may know exactly what it refers to. So, Jeremy, is that sound?
Yeah, I venture to say that it's an intentionally broad term because it covers such a wide spectrum of information. It's one of those kinds of things that's hard to define because it's such a broad thing.
Okay.
So, you know.
Well.
Okay. Mr. Hero.
I think.
Pass the mic.
Okay. Well, I actually had one more thing I wanted to add, but I can do that later.
I come to this panel a little out of my depth as far as technical issues go. I approach information security, information competitive intelligence at a higher strategic level, a political level, if you will. And I think that a definition that I would apply to competitive intelligence would be being able to target that information, which allows you to apply maximum force at decisive points. What those decisive points are, that may shift over time, they may be very fluid, but the only value that any intelligence you're ever going to be able to gather is whether or not you're actually going to be able to use it. It's an old Clausewitzian dictum that maximum force at decisive points is how you win a war. And it's in the history of this country at least, it's been the classical American way in war.
Okay, what I wanted to add before was it was really what I was saying was leading up to one simple statement, and that is to narrow it down a little bit. Competitive intelligence, quite simply, is information that one entity can leverage against another entity for some objective. And I don't think anyone would disagree with that. Jeremy?
Just say corporate espionage and be done with it.
Okay, let's just say corporate espionage and be done with it, or espionage period and be done with it.
Well, no, I think that's even too narrowing a definition to say.
I was just kidding about the espionage thing.
You're dead, sorry. I'm set.
All right. We'll just give the microphone to Mudge, and everyone else will relax for about a half an hour.
You haven't had enough to drink yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. One thing we did want to touch over that Richard wrote down here was talk about the real hackers out there, okay? Not kids using scripts, not defacing websites. Those people we all see on a daily basis. We all read Hacker News. The people that we all need to be afraid of as IT security professionals and did I say something wrong?
No.
That's what I am. Okay.
The people that we all need to be afraid of are...
Oh, no, they're not them too, but the people that we do need are the ones that actually go in and we never see, okay? They're the ones that we're trying to detect, that we're trying to protect. We all have seen evidence of it too much after the fact. Unfortunately, everyone like the New York Times and all these persons that and companies that get their web page hacked, I don't think that they see the real danger and what's going on behind the scenes. Example.
Well, I want to expound on that a little bit further. A lot of it's perception management. The reason why a lot of these, you know, corporate America and whatnot are really concerned with the average kid out there who's going to break in and deface their web page is because it's perception management. That's obviously going to affect their public image a lot. And, you know, this is all stuff we all know. It makes them look bad. However, you know, the real problem are the people that you don't hear about, the things that can go on, again, corporate espionage, things of that nature. And does that happen? You know, definitely yes, of course.
I mean, it's more about having an objective. You know, if you're somebody who's wandering around looking for sites that are hackable and you find a site, then probably your objective is going to be to deface that site. But the real danger is the people who set out with a specific objective. Like, for instance, if you find that the New York Times website is hackable, if you go and, you know, deface the website, it's going to get changed a day later. But something much more subtle could be done. You could, for instance, go and change the facts and lots of stories in their archives. They never go back and check that stuff. And that would totally ruin their credibility if, you know, somebody notices a year later that they've had all this stuff posted that is just factually incorrect. But like I said, it's more about having an objective.
Get in there. I'll give a real-world example. Sorry. The loft was approached not too long ago by a large organization that was engaging in a bunch of e-commerce stuff. And this large organization did a lot of crypto stuff, a lot of X.509 certificates, food, fuel, gas, ice cold beer, and X.509 certificates, as they all do. And they said, we're worried about this website because we're going to run an ad in the, I believe it was, what's the Wall Street Journal saying, you know, here's our new service, you know, come and check it out. And they're like, maybe we should get somebody to look at this from a security conscious point of view first. I said, well, that's a brilliant idea. Yeah, so they're like, what are you worried about? And they were worried about somebody coming in and defacing their website because they're like, we're advertising all this great security, you know, it's secure transactions, it's big money that's going across the wire here, and they were worried about their website being defaced. So we said, okay, we'll take this contract on. We took the contract on. We don't normally do contracts unless they dangle big carrots in front of our face. Or it's fun. That's the key part. So we got into the website. Yay, surprise. And we took it over. And do you think we defaced the website? No. There was big money going on there. That website ran cleaner and more spotless than they ever could have imagined from that point on. That's what you need to be scared of. Because the thing is, we siphon the, you know, approximately $25,000 a week off of that into a fictitious account. They were worried entirely about defacing websites. They're worried about somebody putting up Nazi propaganda. They're worried about somebody putting up, ha ha, your security sucks, you've been hacked. You know, if you want to protect against that level, that's fine. Those are the ankle biters. You know, you put the floods on or you get the stilts out, you know, you raise the bar a little bit, boom, gone. You know, if you're dealing with that level, fine, deal with that level. You're hosed when it comes to the next level. The next level that you have to deal with is where all the fun comes in.
That's an excellent point. What I wanted to say, talked a little bit about what Josh Sardistic was saying. Sorry. My bad. He was talking about, let me see if I can remember now. I went off topic.
Remember objectives.
Objectives, that's right. And he was talking about changing information. Well, that's an excellent point. One very salient attack, which I think is going to be, you know, something to look at, is information poisoning. You know, not you break in, you cover your tracks, and instead of you know, defacing the web page or you know, stealing things outright, you know, you change facts, you know, for whatever your objective may happen to be. And that's something that you know, other guys may want to comment on. One other thing I wanted to mention was, sort of along the lines of objective, is data mining. And when you're, you know, in the course of, I was doing a gig recently, we were on a large government contractor, we were doing an internal assessment, and part of they wanted to know was, can you find any black stuff? You know, can you find any classified stuff? We're not supposed to be able to. We were on an unclassified segment. And during the course, you know, we found some stuff that probably shouldn't have been there. We found a lot of data files. And we didn't know exactly what to do with these data files because they were, you know, arbitrary-looking binary files. Had we had, like, a specific objective in mind and knew what, you know, type of data to look for, then definitely, you know, we were malicious intent. Definitely. Something bad could have happened from that. One other point of note there was they, you know, they have, obviously they have a lot of competitors in the field. It's a very, you know, big field. And I guess as some contract happened, they needed to work with a competitor. And as it happened, the competitor had direct access fully to their network, and we were able to go from one network to the other. And, you know, immediately there, you know, you're spreading the risk. You know, there's transit of trust. You know, one guy goes down, the rest fall.
Just as an example of information poisoning that happened 6 to 8 months ago, one of the government's Tiger teams, and I believe it was the Air Force Red Team. Is it the Air Force?
The Club Bank stuff?
Yeah. They were doing some Tiger Team stuff in some various databases and systems, and basically testing to see if they could break in and whatnot. And one of the systems they checked, they tested or broke into was the medical databases of government personnel. And one of the things they did is they changed the blood types on those people. They didn't tell anybody they were doing this. I mean, there's the Air Force, they don't have to. So they changed the blood types, and well, finally somebody realized it and raised the holy terror and said, hey, we've been hacked, blood types have been changed, and the Air Force came in and owned up to it. But it just goes to give you an example of the types of information that can be changed and altered, and nobody knows about it, and the web page wasn't defaced. Another case in point, recent, I believe it was the NOAA website that was defaced. The administrators of that site didn't even know they had been hacked until like 6 hours later when somebody called them up and told them. And if that sort of thing can go on for that long, it's amazing what if somebody had been determined to go in and change data or poison the information, how long that data would have stayed inaccurate on the site, available to people to reference, before somebody finally said, hey, something's going on here.
Just one second. Another issue with information poisoning is that if the information is the incorrect information is around long enough, it eventually ends up getting integrated into any backups that are there. And after a certain amount of time, you have no backups of the original data, and you lose the original data. And again, it's about, you know, doing something subtle enough that it just isn't initially noticed.
I just thought at this point, before we get too far into the details of poisoning, etc., that I might try to bring to the discussion a little higher look at what intelligence provides. As information gets compressed, more time into less space, we have intelligence. There used to be a system whereby intelligence flowed up the ladder. He had the originator of the intelligence, the human intelligence, the person in the field, go to his section manager, further up until it got up to the top of the line, whether it be the DCI of intelligence or whoever, a decision would be made, handed off to the policy decision maker. With a networked world, that's all changed. The originators of intelligence, which are you people, are also the disseminators of intelligence. Your consumers, exactly. And as this data flows faster and faster and faster, you have a danger of information overload. There's too much out there. So we start talking about, well, you know, we can write this particular piece of software to analyze this particular piece of data, and we can data mine and all that. That's great, but unless you know what to do with the information or the intelligence, it's useless, absolutely useless. What you may see is a shift towards, in my opinion, at any rate, information dominance, the ability to control the flow of information and thereby the intelligence that you are able to glean from it. there's a very real possibility of disinformation when you talk about poisoning. It may come to the point where you've come to the realization, well, you know, there's just no way that we can stop this flow of information. So we can do one of two things. We can try to burn them out, cram as much down the pipe as we can, or we can send small bits of false stuff, because maybe that's what people are watching for. They're watching for the gaps in the information now. A classical strategist wrote about intelligence. Sun Tzu wrote about how information is king. And in American society, or American way of war, and especially in intelligence communities, and I would think that this would flow down to corporate America, is very much, again, this Clausewitzian idea of maximum force at decisive points. We always hear about gathering of intelligence. We have corporate intelligence. I've got, you know, the latest roadmap of ISS's plans for product XYZ. I work for Network Associates. Great, I've got that information. Now, what do I do with it? It's about policy. At the end of the day, if you don't know what you're going to do with the information, if you have no idea what value this information brings to you, it's useless.
I just want to mention a brief thing about, you know, talking about dissemination of disinformation or, you know, poisoned information. And it's stuff that, if it's done with a purpose, you know, can be very pointed. It's stuff, you know, this has been done in the intelligence community for years. You know, you find out somebody, oops, a double agent, oops, somebody, there's a mole in our, you know, organization. Well, we found out before he knows we found out. We give him false information and find out how far we can, you know, follow him and whatnot. So, of course, the difference being that if disinformation was, you know, spread out through a corporate type of environment, or even worse, you know, throughout like the consumer environment, the results could be far more disastrous and far-reaching.
On that point, Richard and I were talking the other day about that kind of thing, and he mentioned the movie The Man That Never Was. It's also a book. Some of you may age here. I had to ask him what it was. I'm 30 years old, so yeah, you're younger. Anyway.
How old?
38.
30?
He was talking about nested modular identities and the manipulation or disinformation that you can do now. You know, in the movie, guy died. They put papers on him. They authenticated the papers. You know, a lot of intelligence people say, you never send an intelligent agent out in the field with a brand new wallet, new credit cards, everything. Why? Because that's what I'm looking for if I'm looking for an agent. You make sure that there's lint in his wallet. You make sure there's, you know, the credit cards have been used for 2 years. You establish an identity, okay? Online identities, people have, for the last 4 years, people have been creating, to my knowledge, creating false online identities. They are creating lint, electronic lint in their wallets, okay? They are creating corporate, government, and military persons and personnels that didn't exist before. They're doing it well, and they're doing it often. And it's something we never think of, because I'm sure there's probably one in this room. I wouldn't doubt it. Seven showed us that, right? But an interesting point about it is the ability to do that, the ability to take identities and form them is easier. Now we have electronic identities that we can form. Does anybody have anything else? We're going to open up for questions soon.
A big thing that we talked about.
Hang on one second.
Jeremy.
Still here? Yeah. I talk loud. You know, a big thing that we did touch upon prior to the panel here when we were discussing this was the intelligence is more than just what you go and steal or what you go and modify, but it's the ability to harness what's given and take separate, you know, disparate sources, merge them together, and form a collective whole out of that information.
Right.
Filtering a huge amount of, you know, information.
Well, exactly. But beyond that, you know, companies, they do press releases or, you know, they do strategic alliances. And it's being able to take the information that seems benign by itself and taking that and integrating it well and coming out with more, coming out with something that's larger than some of its parts.
I'm just going to pick one.
Go ahead.
Part and parcel of that is the danger in collecting corporate intelligence or any sort of intelligence is that you mirror image. You have no choice but to view the information that you get through your own set of filters. Okay, so you've got this problem with mirror imaging, and if you screw it up, boom.
Back with what you were saying about data intelligence, Senator Cohen recently commissioned a reserve unit to monitor government websites, not because the websites were putting up classified information, but because it was felt that the gathering of the unclassified information and putting it all together into one big chunk could lead people to, or the enemy, to assume information that was classified. So there's now a reserve unit that just goes around and surfs government websites for information that's unclassified but may be put together to be made classified.
All right, well, before we go into the questions, then, I guess, being a person who likes to deal with the practical stuff, I have a little bit of a difficult time extrapolating and interpreting a lot of what this goes on into my own real-world environment. So I figured what we'd do is actually look at some real-world examples as to how easy it actually is to get extremely competitive and extremely, we'll use the phrase, confidential information about a particular company. And let's make this a little bit more of a group participation ordeal. And I want five different ways from people out there through public services that you can get what might be considered sensitive data from another organization. And I'll start with hands. You.
Satellite feeds, open satellite feeds.
Ouch. Wow. Okay. Going difficult right off the beginning. But
farming starts in 5 minutes, for example.
Satellite feeds are very good. Another particular method is if you were looking at particular communication satellites, a lot of those black out very quickly, even though they are not, quote unquote, under military control. The ACT satellite, for instance, was very interesting. I mean, that's Motorola and NASA, for God's sakes, and it's supposed to be a research thing. And any time anything interesting happens, the entire thing goes black to be given back later. Yes, it's that's a good way. That's number one. Yeah. Traveling patterns of employees of companies. Okay, I like that one. That's really good. You can definitely traffic analysis is a wonderful thing. If anybody wants to make a mint in the stock market, sniff any of the smaller pharmaceutical companies and see where their email patterns are actually going out to. As soon as they start doing heavy email patterns to larger pharmaceutical companies, they're about to try and release something by stock, theoretically. Number three. Yep, SEC filings, trademarks, patents, zoning areas, you name it for, like, I mean, go down to the library. Hey, I'm up at three. I got two more. Hey, back off. That's three. Two more. Yeah.
Right, Marin, name server databases.
Name server databases. Oh. That's good stuff. Same thing like 411.com, yellowpages.com, amazing stuff. Whenever we look at a company, one of the first moves to figure out like who's there for like usernames and is to go to like 411.com and say, you know, companyfoo.com, give me all the addresses there. Boom, all the user accounts. Thank you very much. That's up to four. Sure.
Probably a really obvious one, but press coverage.
Lexis Nexus Surf.
Because PR does not run everything through security before they release it to the press.
So that's 4.5.
Everyone knows. I don't think necessarily stuff that they release, but stuff about them. That's what's really the deal.
Okay, that's 4.5. Yeah, call them up. You always get those emails going like, we are in a sensitive time right now of the company. If you get phone calls, and I don't know who else gets phone calls. I get phone calls about that stuff all the time. It's just like, it's none of your business. What about anonymous FTP servers? Mm-hmm. Has anybody taken a look at, I'm on a roll, at anonymous FTP servers? You can get DMS 100, 5ESS switches, the phone numbers for them, the passwords to log into them for all the major phone companies out there, because they're all on the freaking anonymous FTP servers. And you can get people's configurations for their Windows systems, because the employees sit there and go, this is my best way to get my stuff home, and they put their any files and everything else up on the FTP server, go home, pull it down anonymous. Walk any major corporation's anonymous FTP server, and you will find the most wonderful things from, we've found at different companies. And are we breaking the law by like walking an anonymous FTP server? They're publishing the stuff. World readable web directories. We've found large organizations with the entire HR salary lists. I mean, the one thing I hate the most is that stupid IBM commercial of the two hackers that are sitting there like, geez, this vice president makes half as much as this one does. Do you know, blah. Well, look, everybody knows. It's on the FTP server. The hell with you guys. Okay, well, there was a lot of really good ideas here for the competitive intelligence. One thing that I think a lot of people forget, and what happens here, is we start trying to make it a lot more difficult than it really is. Look at the obvious stuff. It's going to be there, because the obvious simple things are the easiest way for people to get work done, and they will take the easiest route once it's given to them. They're like a really good routing protocol. Shortest cost will be done. Yeah.
Security is seldom convenient, and people will circumvent it, any way they can.
On the note, travel patterns, that kind of thing, Serdistic and I worked on one situation to where we tracked the president of a company's complete travel itinerary for, how long did you run that thing? Through his email patterns, okay? Not what was in them. We don't really give a crap what was in them. We don't need to know. We wanted to know when he was at the office, because he answered his email, guess what, at 8:20 a.m. when he came into the office. We knew he was in the office. Those kind of situations, you don't think about, hey, I know what time I answer my email when I get into work, right? Everyone, like what Mudge was saying, it's very simple to look at these kind of patterns, and this is the kind of thing that people are looking for in competitive intelligence.
I think that's exactly right, and I think, I mean, the thing is, the way basically I was monitoring, when this guy was in his office and whatnot was through, one of the most obvious ways possible. I was fingering his account, and it told me how much unread mail he had. When it went from 1 to 0, he's there reading his mail. It's pretty straightforward. At any rate, a lot of also what I deal with is just trying to find the identity of a person who's online, and if I can basically get it down to that IP address, 90% of the time, if it's a Windows box, their Windows machine name is their real name, or they log into their Windows machine as their real name, and maybe they their domain name is their last name, and they log in as their first name, but you take all the little bits of information, you finger their account and see what username it reports it as, and a lot of times you take all those little things and put them together, which are all really obvious and really accessible, and you get an identity out of it.
What?
Yeah.
We got to move on to questions.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead and open.
Yeah, I think we're going to open the panel to questions and answers now, so if anybody would like to ask a question, please raise your hand. Let's all point to somebody different. You're absolutely correct. And one of the main things that's been changing is that everybody and their grandmother is now on the internet, and most of them don't know how to use it right. Most, because the technology has been the field has been expanding so much lately, we've got more and more systems administrators that don't know what they're doing, and they're opening up more and more holes. Not only that, but the technology itself has changed. Windows 95 wasn't around 10 years ago. It was something different than granted, and there was some way to get the information from there too. But the point is that there's always new products out there, and especially with Microsoft trying to What? And especially with Microsoft, you know, trying to remove the user from the actual computer farther and farther, and putting friendlier and friendlier layers between them. The actual, you know, what information is available from your machine, most people have no idea. Most people have no idea you can remotely get, you know, a machine name and their username and log in, let alone, you know, actually connect to shares and stuff across the internet.
Right, because if I gotta do it, I'm not coming through your router and your firewall. I'm not coming through your router and your firewall to get information on your president on your internal network. I'm finding out where he lives. He's running Windows 95. 90%. Hypothetically.
Did you want it? Oh, sorry. So another comment here.
I would argue that nothing has changed. Absolutely nothing. What has changed is the means, but not the ends. So 15 years ago, the means weren't there. So yes, it's more information available, but the reasons behind, the reasons behind doing this hasn't changed at all.
No, but
it's more it's compressed more information, less time, less space. Great, I got a whole whack of data, and I got these incredible means to do this, but my reasons for doing it are exactly the same as they were 15 years ago, and I believe that was part of what your question is. What has changed? Essentially, only the means. The ends are the same. I'm sorry? I don't know about that. I think that, you know, with the advent of, you know, faster processors and
more accessible.
Absolutely, easily, certainly more accessible. But the means are
ubiquitous access across the board is definitely going to change the means.
Let's all start taking people's information. Do you think the awareness over the last, say, 20 or 30 years of threats that competitive intelligence compares to corporations is increasing or decreasing? And
can I answer that? Okay, the question he's asking is has the level of awareness changed over the last 30 years in regard to the issues we're discussing? And the point I was actually trying to make in response to his question was that because there, you know, 30 years ago, because the field has expanded so much, the percentage of people who are aware about these issues is going down and down, the more people that there are in this field. That was the point I was trying to make.
You back there
The awareness is decreasing as the number of people who are involved increase, because they all start off unaware, and unless they are made aware, they don't know.
Yes, sir.
The final end users for this competitive intelligence, have they changed? Have you seen them becoming more sophisticated or whatever?
The end users?
I'm less concerned if you all can track where I am every day. I might be concerned if somebody who I don't want that information.
But what's the difference? If we can do it, somebody else can do it. If they can't do it, if we can do it, somebody else can do it. And if they can't do it, they can hire somebody else who can.
Time and money.
I guess I'm asking, can you be a little more specific than that?
A little more specific about what?
In the sense of, have you seen organizations more interested in
I go for $550 an hour. And you gotta write the get out of jail free card.
I think the answer to your question is yes. Companies are becoming more aware that the possibilities and usages for this type of information retrieval are there, and that because that, you know, they are realizing this, that yes, it is becoming more of an issue.
And the end user is usually only concerned, like you or mom or dad, if they have a web page. Other than that, they don't care.
Yes.
I would agree that the availability of the access is the same as it's been for the last 15 years, but now the granularity of what data you get once you find out where the CEO is going and how to gain the access, then you can gain the data that you couldn't get, which was on a mainframe. My question is more towards what is the survivability that you believe any corporate may be able to put in place today that would make them actually survive an attack like this?
I think Dean touched on a good point of that in the policy. It all starts on what they're looking for. You have to decide what's, as a corporation, what is valuable, what information doesn't need to be released, what information doesn't need to be made publicly available, go back to the need to know and all that.
Right. Well,
I think I'd like to add to that more the enforcement piece. We all have, probably everybody in this room has had somebody write policies for them. We have policies.
It has to start there.
We know it's human nature. Once you're a Fortune 100 company and you have over so many employees, you have a certain percentage who are going to let people in.
Sure.
Asking a basic question, though. In the corporate environment in the U.S. today, they've written articles saying about, hey, not for Pearl Harbor, but for the commercial sector that are sitting here, what's their survivability in that sector?
What should you? Well, I mean, I hate to say it. In my opinion, at least at this point, you know, write a good policy, write the, you know, airtight, watertight policy, and adhere to it. You know, everyone's got to adhere to it. That's you know, initially without adherence to, you know, the correct security policy, which of course, you know, isn't going to happen. So you can, what you can, you can hope for is best effort, and what you have to do is you have to be prepared to make a few concessions. And, you know, you have to be prepared to deal with the consequences of when, you know, those things go wrong. Of course, you need to be prepared to deal with consequences, worst case scenario. But, you know, then in reality, chances are hopefully that stuff doesn't happen. But, you know, if you want to talk like buzzwords, sure, IDS is you know, a good place to start, I suppose. I'm sure Jeremy would like to make a few comments about that.
No.
Okay, he wouldn't.
We're not talking about IDS.
We're not talking about IDS.
Prioritization.
Prioritization, real quickly. I think you're hosed. As soon as you become a really, really large organization, you're hosed. Unless you start segmenting everything off and breaking it off into relatively autonomous business units. I'd proffer to bet that in reality, out of here, out of any company that you're with, if we went down like the row and asked everybody in the corporation, I'm imagining that most of the people here are involved with security there at whatever organization they're with, that most of the people in this room do not know what the crown jewels are of their company, what they're protecting. You can't write a policy if you don't know what the crown jewels are.
And furthermore, how can you realistically, one, two, three people, you know, even a team of people, how can you realistically come up with an excellent policy and execute it across like 100,000, 200,000 machines? Of course, this is a large installation. How about 5,000 machines? Even that's very daunting. You know, I'm sure everyone up here has been in those environments, and it's just amazing what you can actually get to and what you can get through.
Education's tough.
I mean, it's hard to sit and write the security policy and say, you know, we're not going to do this, we're not going to release that information, we're not going to say this because it can be construed against us, and then have the PR people just go ahead and let it all out anyway in a press release. So, I mean, and you have to educate the employees and as well as have the proper policies in place.
I have a comment to make about that. And then we'll move. Yeah, I saw a real world example of that right there. I've worked for two, you know, large corporations, and you know, in the past couple of years, and I haven't gone to the new employee orientations at all. And I'm, surely there's going to be stuff relating to security, you know, disclosure of information and whatnot, policy. I haven't gone to them. I'm sure a lot of people here have you know, skipped out on the same thing. Why would you want to go to it? You know, they're boring. I don't. End of story, I guess.
Yes, sir.
Over there.
Yes, sir.
You. No, you.
Oh.
You.
Perhaps a strange question for this round, but what are your positions on ethics in practicing computer competitive intelligence?
In what capacity? In what capacity? Are you talking like sort of in a recreational sense, like that type of stuff? Because we're not. That's the type of question we're trying to avoid.
As a practicer of competitive intelligence.
As a gatherer?
Gatherer, you mean?
Nope. Restricting yourself to certain types of information, freely publicly available information, or pursuing.
Well, generally, when we're gathering. Okay, at least I can speak for myself, when I'm gathering competitive information and whatnot, usually it's because I'm being paid by a company to do so, and I have a hold harmless agreement. You know, the intellectual property to take with me after that, you know, is obviously I can't erase my mind after, you know, I know all your corporate secrets and things of that nature. You know, but I'm not sure I understand exactly what, you know,
are you
what the thrust of your question.
Personally, what our ethics are, or what do you think the ethics are between different businesses?
Are you saying, I mean, sure, I go out, we go at, you know, my company X.
Ethical limitations, I think is what he's asking.
Actually, I think you should answer the question.
Your position with regard to somebody coming to you and saying, I want you to gather intelligence on or information.
Is the question how far we will go?
Would we go to work for the mob? Is that what you're saying?
No. Basically,
he's asking, would you work for Uncle Sam?
No, I didn't even hear the whole question because you guys wouldn't stop talking.
Some of us already have. He's asking basically how far you would go to get him. No?
Would you break the law? Would you
Right. Well, the thing is, all right, I'm going to answer this question in the context. I'm going to answer this question in the context of. We're actually being employed by a company to test their security or audit their networks and whatnot. It's usually written up in the proposal agreement. Don't touch these machines. Don't do any physical on-site stuff. Don't do this. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes you're. But obviously, are we going to go and rubber hose somebody? I haven't done that.
I'd like to address something you just said. You know, will we break our blah blah blah? I actually did a pretty long job for someone intelligence gathering. They told me it was one thing. Turns out they lied. Okay, and it turns out the people that were three people beyond the people were somebody that I disagreed with morally and ethically in the way I live, and you know now I have to live with that. But I'm never doing work for that person again. Every person on here has that set of ethics, they do have their own set of ethics and morals, and I don't think that should be addressed here. I can only speak for me. We don't have time to go through everyone else, but you know.
I think there's an important point here to be made. I think that asking the question to the panelists, from my point of view, is the wrong question. The question is, in competitive intelligence, are there people who will stoop to...
Definitely.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Now...
Highest bidder.
Now
what's your answer to your own question? Yeah. Which is why we have to be careful.
Yes, the statement was, I mean, are there people in competitive? Of course, it's big money. Sure. Money is what makes this, you know, country go around. And, you know, whoever has the most can get whatever the hell they want. Now, an interesting point of that is, a lot of times you don't have to break the law in order to get all this information. And if you don't have to break the law and you get the information, you win on both counts. Okay. Because now, you have the information and the other company can't do squat about it.
Here's had his hand up for like 10 minutes. Let's get him.
Two points. The first one is, you all laid out a really good baseline for information gathering, but to me and to practitioners of competitive intelligence, gathering the information is only one part of the puzzle.
Exactly.
That intelligence professional that competitive intelligence professional that can sit down and take the data that's been mined or gathered.
Exactly, collate. We sort of did touch down on that.
Not just collate, but analyze.
Sure.
Just information.
Right. Yeah, and that's precisely what the point is. The information is useless if you don't know what to do with it.
The other point I wanted to say is, society out there, competitive intelligence professionals, that talks about ethics, that talks about the right way to do things like this, in this manner. And I said, right, I mean, ethical way to do things. And
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think ethics, you're going to find that ethics are bounded by a weighing of the penalty and risks versus the rewards, pure and simple. It's like that at a national security level. It's like that at a corporate level. It's like that at an individual level. You weigh every single decision you make, every piece of information you mine, based on the reward versus the risk and penalty. That's how you do it.
And the time associated with the retreat.
Well, I mean, if the reward is high enough, I would argue that anyone in this room, if the reward was high enough, that you will take the information.
Yeah, one more question, then we got to cut it off.
You talk a lot about breaking into stuff, that's why we think there's a lot of statistics that show that a lot of information compromises are internal. And there's a lot of wondering what kind of comments you guys have.
Okay, I have two initial comments right off the bat. One is I really dislike hearing that, well, such and such statistics is this much. Who's making these statistics, and how can you realistically, with such an, you know, look at the environment, the internet as a whole, and how can you realistically come up with any statistics? Most break-ins aren't even reported. But that being said, I agree with. That being said, I do agree with the fact that, the statistic that most break-ins are internal, because they are. And there's a lot of reasons for that.
82.7%.
82.7% was, I believe, the last figure I heard. There's a lot of reasons for that. In my mind, well, there are a few. The major one is because it's so much, it's so goddamn easy in comparison. I mean, you take Company X, who's got, a relatively hardened choke point, and that's the only real way in. Just forget dial-in. If I can walk on site posing, of course posing is, we've all talked about the social engineering aspect, but Christ, it's so much easier. It's so much easier. And this guy really has really been wanting to ask his question, so last.
Throughout this whole discussion, I mean, it seems glaringly obvious that the risk-to-gain ratio has far surpassed, what the gain is, okay, exactly what Dean was talking about. And so what I'm really interested in is why we haven't seen a cyber Pearl Harbor, a massive, huge...
Don't use that term in this room.
Because an information attack is overrated.
There is also a degree of hype involved with these types of things. That one thing needs to be kept in mind.
Successful hacks you don't hear about.
Really successful bad things you might not hear about. The real bad stuff. Was it Citibank? I probably shouldn't even quote them.
The NRO story.
Massive thing that you can't avoid hearing about. Planes crashing.
Who's gonna band together and launch such a concentrated information attack on so many systems?
Okay, here's a question, Aaron. Would you consider the theft of a critical source tree to be a corporate Pearl Harbor for a company?
No.
But it could be.
Because of Dean's point, which is this information has to be focused into a destruction.
One second, please. Come on, everybody.
Then my point is that this information hasn't been focused in a maximal destructive effort, which is Dean's point. Please move it. We haven't seen this.
I think honestly that there exists a very real danger of government sponsored info warfare attacks. I think the whole idea of electronic Pearl Harbor is vastly overrated. It's only one of the many dimensions that strategy will involve. And I think we run the risk and the danger of getting lost in little tiny details, because you've got to look at the big picture.
Everyone saw Cheswick's talk about, what was it, the day after?
And I'm done after saying that. That's all I wanted to bring up. Is the fact that, some scenarios, they are definitely planned and worked out and blah, blah, blah. And
we do have to
close, though.
What is the result of the quote-unquote informational warfare Pearl Harbor? What do you gain from taking down the entire internet? We know the internet can be taken down. There were a bunch of punk-ass hackers that were testifying in front of the Senate who said that.
Question to ask yourself. What constitutes an act of war today?